A merry tune was playing farther on, a dancing, ragged melody. A smell of roasting tim leaves, sweet and softening. You could almost feel them turning up their purplish edges. Yackel led the way, and the 23 revelers processed in a confused state of apprehension, elation, and randiness. The dwarf followed behind. Bach took stock, as best his stumbling mind could manage. An erect tiger in hip boots and a cape. A couple of bankers and their evening consorts, all wearing black masks. As a protection against blackmail, or as an aphrodisiac. A party of merchants from Ev and Fleon, in town on business. A couple of women, rather long in the tooth, bedecked in costume jewelry. The honeymoon couple were Glickens. Bach hoped that his crowd wasn't gawping as much as the Glickens were. As he glanced around, only Averick and Shenshen looked eager. And Fiuro, possibly because he hadn't yet grasped what this was all about. The others looked more than a little squeamish. They entered a small, dark theater in the round, with the space for the public divided into six stalls. Above, the ceiling was lost in a stony blackness. Tapers fluttered, and a hollow music issued through fissures in the wall, increasing an unearthly air of dislocation and otherness. The stalls circled and faced the central stage, which was enshrouded in black drapes. The stalls were separated from one another by vertical strips of latticed wood and slats of mirror. All the parties were being mixed up, all friends and partners separated. Was there incense in the air, too? It seemed to make Bach's mind split in half, like a husk, and allow a tenderer, complacent mind to emerge. The softer, more bruisable aspect, the private intention, the surrendering self. He felt he was knowing less and less, and it was more and more beautiful to do so. Why had he been alarmed? He was sitting on a stool, and around him in the stall sat, almost preternaturally near, a man in a black mask, an asp he hadn't noticed before, the tiger whose breath ran hot and meaty on his neck, a beautiful schoolgirl, or was that the bride on her honeymoon? Did the whole stall then tilt forward like a gently swung bucket? Anyway, they leaned together toward the central dais, an altar of veils and sacrifices. Bach loosened his collar, and then his belt, felt the gingery appetite between heart and stomach, and the resulting stiffening apparatus below that. The music of pipes and whistles was slowing, or was it that, as he watched and waited and breathed so slowly, that the secret area inside himself uncloaked itself, where nothing mattered? The dwarf, in a darker hood now, appeared on the stage. He could see from his vantage point into all the stalls, but the revelers in separate stalls couldn't see one another. The dwarf leaned and reached a hand here, there, welcoming, beckoning. He encouraged from one stall the figure of a woman, from another a man. Was it Tibbet? And from the stall where Bach sat, he gestured to the tiger. Bach felt only faintly sorry not to be chosen himself as he watched the dwarf pass a smoking vial beneath the nostrils of the three acolytes and help them to remove their clothes. There were shackles and a tray of scented oils and emollients and a chest whose contents were still in shadow. The dwarf bound black blindfolds around the heads of the scholars. The tiger was pacing on all fours and growling softly, tossing his head back and forth in distress or excitement. Tibbet, for it was he, though nearly out of consciousness, was made to lie on his back on the floor of the stage. The tiger strode over him and stood still, while the dwarf and his assistants lifted Tibbet and tied his wrists together around the tiger's chest, and his ankles around the tiger's pelvis. So Tibbet hung beneath the tiger's belly like a trussed pig, his face lost in the tiger's chest hair. The woman was set on a sloping stool, almost like a huge tilting bowl, and the dwarf tucked something aromatic and runny up in the shadowy regions. Then the dwarf pointed to Tibbet, who was beginning to twist and moan into the tiger's chest. "Let X be the unknown god," said the dwarf, poking Tibbet in the ribs. The dwarf then slapped the tiger on his flank with a riding crop, and the tiger strained forward, positioning his head between the woman's legs. "Let Y be the dragon of time in its cave," said the dwarf, hitting the tiger again. As he laced the woman into the half-shell, stroking her nipples with a glowing salve, he handed her a riding crop with which she could lash at the tiger's flanks and face. "And let Z be the Cumbric witch, and let us see if she exists tonight." The crowd drew nearer, almost participants themselves, and the musky sense of adventure made them tear at their own buttons and nibble their own lips, leaning in. "Such are the variables in our equation," said the dwarf, as the room darkened even further. "So now let the true clandestine study of knowledge begin." The industrialists of Shiz, from an early stage wary of the growing power of the wizard, had elected not to lay down the rail line from Shiz to the Emerald City as originally planned. Therefore, it was a good 3 days' journey from Shiz to the Emerald City, and this was in the best of weather, for the wealthy who could pay for a constant change of horses. For Glinda and Elphaba, it took more than a week. A bleak, cold-scoured week, as the winds of autumn ripped the leaves off trees with a dry screech and a rattle of brittle, protesting limbs. They rested, like other third-class travelers, in the back rooms above inn kitchens. In a single lumpy bed, they huddled together for warmth and encouragement, and, Glinda told herself, protection. The ostlers cooed and shrieked in the stable-yard below. The kitchen-maids came and went noisily at odd hours. Glinda would start as if from a frightful dream, and nestle in nearer to Elphaba, who seemed at night never to sleep. Daytimes, the long hours spent in poorly sprung carriages, Elphaba would nod off against Glinda's shoulder. The land outside grew less succulent and varied. Trees were crabbed, as if conserving their strength. And then the sandy scrubland was domesticated by farm life. Overgrazed fields were dotted with cows, their withers shriveled and papery, their lowing desperate. An emptiness settled in the farmyards. Once Glinda saw a farm woman standing on her doorstep, hands sunk deep in apron pockets, face lined with grief and rage at the useless sky. The woman watched the carriage pass, and her face showed a yearning to be on it, to be dead, to be anywhere else other than on this carcass of a property. The farms gave way to deserted mills and abandoned granges. Then, abrupt and decisive, the Emerald City rose before them. A city of insistence, of blanket declaration. It made no sense, clotting up the horizon, sprouting like a mirage on the characterless plains of central Oz. Glinda hated it from the moment she saw it. Brash upstart of a city. She supposed it was her Gilliconese superiority asserting itself. She was glad of it. The carriage passed through one of the northern gates, and the scramble of life aroused itself again, but in an urban key, less restrained and self-forgiving than that of Shiz. The Emerald City was not amused by itself, nor did it consider amusement a proper attitude for a city. Its high self-regard sprang up in public spaces, ceremonial squares, parks and facades, and reflecting pools. "How juvenile! How devoid of irony!" murmured Glinda. "The pomp! The pretension!" But Elphaba, who had passed through the Emerald City only once before, on her way up to Shiz, had no interest in architecture. She had her eyes glued on the people. "No animals," she said. "Not so you can see, anyway. Maybe they have all gone underground." "Underground?" said Glinda, thinking of legendary menaces like the Gnome King and his subterranean colony, or dwarves in their mines in Glickus, or the time dragon of the old myths dreaming the world of Oz from his airless tomb. "In hiding," said Elphaba. "Look, the poor. I mean, are they the poor? The hungry of Oz? From the failed farms? Or is it just the surplus? The expendable human selvage?" "Look at them, Glinda. This is a real question. The Quadlings, having nothing, looked more than these." Off the boulevard on which they rode branched alleys, where shelves of tin and cardboard served as roofs for the flood of indigents. Many of them were children, though some were the diminutive Munchkinlanders, and some were dwarves, and some were Gilliconese, bowed with hunger and strain. The carriage moved slowly, and faces stood out. A Glickan youth with no teeth and no feet or calves, on his stumpy knees in a box, begging. A Quadling. "Look, a Quadling," said Elphaba, grabbing Glinda's wrist. Glinda caught a glimpse of a ruddy brown woman in a shawl, lifting a small apple to the child in a sling around her neck. Three Gilliconese girls dressed like women for hire. More children in a pack, running and squealing like piglets, pressing up against a merchant to pick his pockets. Rag merchants with pushcarts. Kiosk keepers whose goods lay locked beneath safety grills. And a sort of civil army, if you could call it that, strolling in foursomes on every second or third street, brandishing clubs, angular with swords. They paid the carriage master and walked with their parcels of clothes toward the palace. It rose in stepped-back fashion, a growth of domes and minarets, high-flared buttresses in green marble, blue agate screens in the recessed windows. Central and most prominent, the broad, gentle-browed canopies of the pagoda lifted over the throne room, covered with hammered scales of virgin gold, brilliant in the late afternoon gloom. 5 days later, they had made it past the gatekeeper, the receptionists, and the social secretary. They had sat for hours awaiting a 3-minute interview with the Commander General of Audiences. Elphaba, a hard, twisted look on her face, had managed to eject the words, "Madame Morrible," from between her clamping lips.
"Tomorrow at 11, said the Commander General, "you will have 4 minutes between the ambassador to Ix and the matron of the Ladies' Home Guard Social Nourishment Brigade. Dress code is formal." He handed them a card of regulations that, being unequipped with courtly dress, they were obliged to ignore. At 3 the following afternoon, everything running late, the ambassador to Ix left the throne room looking agitated and splenetic.
Glinda fluffed the bedraggled feathers in her travelling hat for the 80th time, and sighed, "Now you're the one who says what should be said." Elphaba nodded. To Glinda, she looked tired, terrified, but strong, as if her form were knit with iron and whiskey instead of bones and blood. The Commander-General of Audiences appeared in the doorway of the waiting salon.
"You have 4 minutes," he said. "Do not approach until you are bade to do so. Do not speak until you are addressed. Do not venture a remark unless it is to answer a comment or question. You may refer to the wizard as Your Highness."
"That sounds pretty regal to me. I thought that royalty had been..." But here Glinda elbowed Elphaba to make her shut up. Really, Elphaba had no common sense sometimes. They hadn't come so far just to be turned away because of adolescent radicalism. The Commander-General took no notice. As they approached a set of tall double doors, carved with sigils and other occult hieroglyphs, the Commander-General mentioned,
"The wizard is not in a good humor today, due to the reports of a riot in the Ugaboo district in the north of Winky Country. I should be prepared for what I find, were I you."
Two stoical doormen opened the doors then, and they passed through. But the throne did not lie before them. Instead, the antechamber led left, and through an archway there was another, but on a shifting axis to the right, and another beyond that, and another. It was like looking through a reflection of a corridor and mirrors set opposite each other. It veered inward. Or, thought Glinda, like processing through the narrowing, deviating chambers of a nautilus. They made a circuit through 8 or 10 salons, each slightly smaller than the other, each steeped in a curdled light that fell from leaded panes above. At last, the antechambers concluded at an archway into a cavernous circular hall, higher than it was wide, and dark as a chapel. Antique wrought-iron stands held ziggurats of moulded beeswax, burning with a multitude of wicks, and the air was close and slightly flowery. The wizard was absent, though they saw the throne on a circular dais, inset emeralds gleaming dully in the candlelight. "He stepped out to use the toilet," said Elphaba. "Well, we'll wait." They stood at the archway, not daring to venture farther without invitation. "If we only have 4 minutes, I hope this doesn't count," said Glinda. "I mean, it took us 2 minutes just to get from there to here." "At this point," said Elphaba, and then, "Shh!" Glinda shhed. She didn't think she heard anything. Then she wasn't sure. There was no change that she could identify in the gloom, but Elphaba looked like a pointer on alert. Her chin was out, her nose high and nostrils flared, her dark eyes squinting and widening. "What?" said Glinda. "What?" "The sound of..." Glinda heard no sounds, unless it was the hot air lifting from the flames into the chilly shadows between dark rafters. Or was it the rustle of silk robes? Was the wizard approaching? She looked this way and that. No. There was a rustle, a sort of hiss, as of bacon rashers in a skillet. The candle flames suddenly all genuflected, obeisant to a sour wind that beat from the area of the throne. Then the dais was pelted with thick drops of rain, and a shudder of homegrown thunder blatted out, more dropped kitchen kettles than timpani. On the throne was a skeleton of dancing lights. At first Glinda thought lightning, but then she realized it was luminescent bones hitched together to suggest something vaguely human, or at least mammalian. The ribcage flexed open like two fretted hands, and a voice spoke in the storm, not from the skull, but from the dark eye of the storm where the heart of the lightning creature should be, in the tabernacle of the ribcage.
"I am Oz, the great and terrible," it said, and shook the room with its related weather. "Who are you?"
Glinda glanced at Elphaba. "Go on, Elfie," she said, nudging her. But Elphaba looked terrified. Well, of course, the rain. She had that thing about rainstorms.
"Who are you?" bellowed the thing, the Wizard of Oz, whatever.
"Elfie," hissed Glinda. Then, "Oh, you useless thing, all talk and no. I'm Glinda, from Frotica, if you please, Your Highness, descended matrilineally from the Arduenas of the Upland. And this, if you please, is Elphaba, the Throp Third Descending from Nest Hardings, if you please."
"And if I don't please," said the wizard.
"Oh, really? How like a child," said Glinda under her breath. "Elfie, come on. I can't say why we're here." But the banal comment of the wizards seemed to snap Elphaba out of her terror. Staying where she was at the edge of the room, gripping Glinda's hand for support, Elphaba said, "We're students of Madame Morrible at Craig Hall in Shiz, Your Highness, and we're in possession of some vital information." "We are?" said Glinda. "Thanks for telling me." The small rain seemed to let up a bit, though the room stayed dark as an eclipse.
"Madame Morrible, that paragon of paradoxes," said the wizard. "Vital information of her, I wonder?"
"No," said Elphaba. "That is, it is not for us to interpret what we hear. Gossip is unreliable, but..."
"Gossip is instructive," said the wizard. "It tells which way the wind is blowing."
The wind then blew in the direction of the girls, and Elphaba danced back to avoid being spattered.
"Go ahead, girls. Gossip."
"No," said Elphaba. "We're here on more important business." "Elfie," said Glinda, "do you want to get us thrown in prison?"
"Who are you to decide what is important business?" roared the wizard.
"I keep my eyes open," said Elphaba. "You didn't call us here to ask for our gossip. We came with our own agenda."
"How do you know I didn't call you here?"
"Well, they didn't know, especially after whatever it was had happened to them at tea with Madame Morrible." "Scale down, Elfie," whispered Glinda. "You're making him mad." "So what?" Elphaba said. "I'm mad." She spoke up again. "I have news of the murder of a great scientist and a great thinker, Your Highness. I have news of important discoveries that he was making, and their suppression. I have every interest in the pursuit of justice, and I know you do too, so that the amazing revelations of Dr. Dillamond will help you to reverse your recent judgments on the rights of animals."
"Dr. Dillamond?" said the wizard. "Is that what all this is about?"
"It is about an entire population of animals systematically deprived of their..."
"I know of Dr. Dillamond, and I know of his work," said the glowing bones of the wizard, snorting. "Derivative, unauthenticated, specious garbage. What you'd expect of an academic animal. Predicated on shaky political notions, empiricism, quackery, tomfoolery, cant, rant, and rhetoric. Were you taken in, perhaps, by his enthusiasm, his animal passion?"
The skeleton danced a jig, or perhaps it was a twitch of disgust.
"I know of his interests and his findings. I know little of what you call his murder, and I care less."
"I am not a slave to emotions," Elphaba said sternly. She was pulling papers from her sleeve, where she had apparently rolled them up around her arm. "This is not propaganda, Your Highness. This is a well-argued theory of consciousness inclination, is what he calls it. And you will be amazed to learn of his discoveries. No right-thinking ruler can afford to ignore the
"That you presume me to be right-thinking is touching," said the wizard. "You may drop the things where you stand, unless you prefer to approach."
The lightning marionette grinned and stretched out its arms.
"My pet?"
Elphaba dropped the papers. "Good, my lord," she said in a piercing, pretentious voice. "I shall take you to be right-thinking, for did I not, I should be obliged to join an army against you." "Oh, hell, Elfie," said Glinda, then more loudly, "she doesn't speak for the both of us, Your Highness. I'm an independent person here." "Please," said Elphaba, at once hard and soft, proud and pleading. Glinda realized she had never before witnessed Elphaba wanting anything. "Please, sir. The hardship on the animals is more than can be borne. It isn't just the murder of Dr. Dillamond. It's this forced repatriation, this chattelizing of free beasts. You must get out and see the sorrow. There is worry that the next step will be slaughter and cannibalism. This isn't merely youthful outrage. Please, sir, this is not untrammeled emotion. What's happening is immoral."
"I do not listen when anyone uses the word immoral," said the wizard. "In the young it is ridiculous. In the old it is sententious and reactionary, and an early warning sign of apoplexy. In the middle-aged, who love and fear the idea of moral life the most, it is hypocritical."
"If not immoral, then what word can I use to imply wrong?" said Elphaba.
"Try mysterious, and then relax a little. The thing is, my green girlie, it is not for a girl or a student or a citizen to assess what is wrong. This is the job of leaders, and why we exist."
"But then nothing would keep me from assassinating you, did I not know what wrong was." "I don't believe in assassination. I don't even know what it means," Glinda called. "Yoo-hoo! I'm going to take my leave now, while I'm still alive."
"Wait," said the wizard. "I have something to ask you."
They stood still. They stood for minutes. The skeleton fingered its ribs, played them like the brittle strings of a harp. Music like stones turning over in a stream bed. The skeleton collected its lighted teeth from its jaws and juggled them. Then it tossed them at the seat of the throne, where they exploded in candy-colored flashes. The rain was running down a drain in the floor, Glinda noticed.
"Madam Morrible," said the wizard, "agent provocateur and gossip, crony and companion, teacher and minister, tell me why she sent you here."
"She didn't," said Elphaba.
"Do you even know the meaning of the word pawn?" shrieked the wizard.
Do you know what resistance means? Elphaba shot back. But the wizard only laughed instead of killing them on the spot.
What does she want of you?
Glinda spoke up. It was about time. A decent education. For all her bombastic ways, she's a capable administrator. It can't be easy. Elphaba was staring at her with a queer, slanted look.
Has she brought you in?
Glinda didn't quite understand. We're only sophisters. We have only begun to specialize, I in sorcery, Elphaba in life sciences.
I see, the wizard seemed to consider. And after you graduate next year?
I suppose I'll go back to Frotica and get married.
And you?
Elphaba didn't answer.
The wizard turned itself around, broke off its femurs, and pounded the seat of the throne as if it were a kettle drum.
"Really, this is getting ridiculous. It's all pleasure-faith showbiz," said Elphaba. She took a step or two forward. "Excuse me, Your Highness, before our time is up?" The wizard turned back. Its skull was on fire, a fire not quenched by the thickening curtain of rain.
"I shall say one last thing," the wizard ventured, in a voice like a groan, a voice of one in pain. "I shall quote from the Ossiad, the hero tale of ancient Oz."
The girls waited. The Wizard of Oz recited,
"Then, hobbling like a glacier, old Cambrisia rubs the naked sky till it rains with blood. She tears the skin off the sun and eats it hot. She tucks the sickle moon in her patient purse. She bears it out, a full-grown changeling stone. Shard by shard she rearranges the world. It looks the same, she says, but it is not. It looks as they expect, but it is not. Beware whom you serve," said the Wizard of Oz.
Then he was gone, and the gutters in the floor gurgled, and the candles went instantly out. There was nothing for them to do but retrace their steps. At the carriage, Glinda had settled in and made a little nest for them in the desirable forward-facing seat, guarding Elphaba's place against three other passengers. "My sister," she lied. "I am saving this seat for my sister." And how I have changed, she thought, in a year and some, from despising the colored girl to claiming we are blood. So university life does change you in ways you cannot guess. I may be the only person in all the Pertha Hills ever to meet our wizard. Not on my own steam, not of my initiative. Still, I was there, I did it, and we're not dead. But we didn't accomplish much. Then there was Elfie at last, barreling along the paving stones with her elbows jutting and her thin, bony torso swathed against the elements, as usual, in a cape. She came up through the crowd, batting at more refined passengers to get past, and Glinda shoved open the door. "Thank heavens, I thought you'd be late," she said. "The driver is eager to leave. Did you get a lunch for us?" Elphaba tossed in her lap a couple of oranges, a hunk of unrepentant cheese, and a loaf of bread that filled the compartment with pungent staleness. "This'll have to do till you're stopped this evening," she said. "Me? Me?" said Glinda. "What do you mean, me? Have you got something better to eat for yourself?"
"Something worse, I expect," said Elphaba.
but needs to be done. I've come to say goodbye. I'm not going back with you to Craig Hall. I'll find a place to study on my own. I'll not be part of Madame Morrible's school again.
No, no, cried Glinda, I can't let you. Nanny will eat me alive. Nessa Rose will die. Madame Morrible will... Elfie, no, no.
Tell them I kidnapped you and made you come here. They'll believe that of me, said Elphaba. She stood on the mounting tread. A fat, Glican female dwarf, having caught the gist of the drama, shifted to the more comfortable seat next to Glinda. They needn't look for me, Glinda, for I'm not going to be findable. I'm going down.
Down where? Back to Quadling country?
That would be telling, Elphaba said. But I won't lie to you, my dear. No need to lie. I don't know yet where I'm going. I haven't decided, so I wouldn't have to lie.
Elfie, get in this cab. Don't be a fool, Glinda cried.
The driver was adjusting the reins and yelling at Elphaba to sod off.
You'll be all right, Elphaba said. Now you're a seasoned traveler. This is just the return leg of a voyage you already know.
She put her face against Glinda's and kissed her.
Hold out if you can, she murmured, and kissed her again. Hold out, my sweet.
The driver clucked the reins and pitched a cry to leave. Glinda craned her head to see Elphaba drift back into the crowds. For all her singularity of complexion, it was astounding how quickly she became camouflaged in the ragamuffin variety of street life in the Emerald City. Or maybe it was foolish tears blurring Glinda's vision. Elphaba hadn't cried, of course. Her head had turned away quickly as she stepped down, not to hide her tears, but to soften the fact of their absence. But the sting to Glinda was real. Part 3. City of Emeralds. On a clammy late summer evening about 3 years after graduating from Shiz University, Fiyero stopped at the Unionist Chapel in St. Glinda's Square to pass some time before meeting a fellow countryman at the opera. Fiyero hadn't taken to Unionism as a student, but he had developed an eye for frescoes that often adorned the cubbyholes of older chapels. He was hoping to find a portrait of St. Glinda. He had not seen Glinda of the Arduenas of the Uplands since her graduation. She had finished a year before he did. But he hoped it wouldn't be sacrilegious to light a charm-wax candle in front of St. Glinda's likeness and to think of her namesake. A service was ending, and the congregation of sensitive adolescent boys and black-scarved grandmothers drifted slowly out. Fiyero waited until the lyre player in the nave had finished fingering a tricky diminuet. Then he approached her.
"Do forgive me. I'm a visitor from the West." Well, obviously, with his rich ochre skin color and tribal markings. "I don't see a sexton, a verger, a sacristan, whatever the word is, nor can I find a pamphlet to tell me I was looking to find an icon of St. Glinda."
Her face remained grave.
"You'll be lucky if it hasn't been papered over with a poster of our glorious wizard. I'm an itinerant musician, only through this way once in a while. But I think you might look in the last aisle. There's an oratory to St. Glinda, or used to be. Good luck."
Locating it, a tomb-like space with an archer's slit instead of a true window, Fiyero saw, lit by a pinkish sanctuary light, a smoky image of the saint, leaning a bit to the right. The portrait was merely sentimental and not robustly primitive, a disappointment.
Water damage had made great white stains like laundry soap mistakes on the saint's holy garments. He couldn't remember her particular legend, nor the uplifting way that she had gagged on death for the sake of her soul and for the edification of her admirers. But then he saw, in the underwatery shadows, that the oratory was inhabited by a penitent. The head was bowed in prayer, and he was about to move away when it struck him that he knew who it was. "Elphaba," he said. She turned her head slowly, a lace shawl dropped to her shoulders. Her hair was looped on her head and skewered with ivory hair corkscrews. Her eyes batted once or twice slowly, as if she were moving toward him from a great distance away. He had interrupted her at prayer. He hadn't remembered her to be religious. Maybe she didn't recognize him. "Elphaba, it's Fiero," he said, moving into the doorway, blocking her exit, and also the light. Suddenly he couldn't see her face, and wondered if he heard correctly when she said, "I beg your pardon, sir." "Elfie, I'm Fiero. We were at Chiz," he said. "My splendid Elfie, how are you?" "Sir, I believe you are mistaking me for someone else," she said, in Elphaba's voice. "Elphaba, the Throp Third Descending, if I remember the nomenclature," he said, laughing stoutly. "I'm not mistaken at all. I'm Fiero of the Arjikis. You know me. You remember me. From Dr. Nicodick's lectures in the life sciences." "You have confused yourself," she said. "Sir." That last word sounded a bit shirty. Absolutely Elphaba. "Now you don't mind if I am about my devotions in peace." She drew her shawl up above her head and arranged it to fall about her temples. The chin in profile could slice a salami, and even in the low light he knew he wasn't wrong. "What is it?" he said. "Elfie. Well, Miss Elphaba, if you require. Don't shab me off like this. Of course it's you. There's no disguising you. What game are you about?" She didn't answer him in words, but by telling her beads ostentatiously, she was telling him to get lost. "I'm not going," he said. "You're interrupting my meditation, sir," she said softly. "Do I have to call the verger and have you removed?" "I'll meet you outside," he said. "How long do you need to pray? Half an hour? An hour? I'll wait." "In an hour, then, across the street, there's a small public fountain with some benches. I'll talk with you for 5 minutes, 5 minutes only, and show you that you've made a mistake. Not a serious one, but increasingly annoying to me." "Forgive the intrusion. In an hour, then. Elphaba." He wasn't going to let her get away with whatever game she was playing. He withdrew, however, and went to the musician at the back of the nave. "Is there another exit to this building besides the main doors?" he asked, over her spurts of arpeggio. When it was convenient to answer him, she tucked her head and moved her eyes. "Side door through to the cloister of the Monts. It's not open to the public, but you can get out to a servant's delivery alley through there." He lingered in the shadow of a pillar. In about 40 minutes, a cloaked figure entered the chapel and moved, hobbling with a cane, directly to the oratory Elfie occupied. He was too far away to hear if words were exchanged or anything else. Perhaps the newcomer was merely another disciple of St. Glinda and wanted solitude to pray. The figure didn't linger. It left again as quickly as its stiff joints would allow. Fiero dropped an offering in the poor box, a note, so to avoid the clink of coin.
In a quarter of the city so infested with the urban poor, his situation of comparative wealth required the penitential gift, though his motivation was characterized more by guilt than charity. Then he slipped out through the side door into an overgrown cloister garden. Some ancient women in wheeled chairs were chortling at the far end and didn't notice him. He wondered if Elphaba belonged to this community of monastic nuns. Monts, they were called. He now remembered that they were females living in that most paradoxical of institutions, a community of hermits. Apparently, however, their vows of silence were revoked in the decay of old age. He decided that Elphaba couldn't have changed that much in 5 years, so he let himself out the servants' entrance into an alleyway. 3 minutes passed, and Elphaba emerged from the same servants' entrance as he had suspected she would. She was intent on avoiding him. Why? Why? The last he had seen of her, he remembered it well, was the day of Amma Clutch's funeral and the drunken party at the pub. She had fled to the Emerald City on some obscure mission, never to return, while he had been dragged off to the eye-opening joys and terrors of the Philosophy Club. Rumor held that the great-grandfather, the eminent Throp, had engaged agents to look for her in Shiz in the Emerald City. From Elphaba herself, there was never a postcard, never a message, never a clue. Nessa Rose had been inconsolable at first, and then grew to resent her sister's putting her through this pain of separation. Nessa had lost herself deeper in religion, to the point where her friends had begun to avoid her. Tomorrow, Fiero would make his apologies for missing the opera and standing up his business colleague. Tonight he would not lose Elphaba. As she hurried through the streets, checking over her shoulder more than once, he thought, if you were trying to lose someone, if you did think someone was on your trail, this is the time of day to do it, not because of shadows, but because of light. Elphaba kept turning corners into the summer sun that, setting, was bowling blinding shafts of light along side streets, through arcades, over the walls of gardens. But he had had many years of practice at stalking animals under similar conditions. Nowhere in Oz was the sun as much an adversary as in the thousand-year grasslands. He knew to squint his eyes and follow the persistence of motion, and forget about identifying by shape. He also knew how to duck sideways without tipping over or losing his balance, how to crouch suddenly, how to look for other clues that the prey had begun to move again, the startled birds, the change in sound, the disrupted wind. She could not lose him, and she could not know he was on her trail. So he wound halfway across the city, from the elegant city center to the low-rent warehouse district, in whose shadowy doorways the destitute made their malodorous homes. Within spitting distance of an army barracks, Elphaba stopped before a boarded-up corn exchange, ferreted a key from some inner pocket, and opened the door. He called from a short distance, in an ordinary voice, "Fabula!" Even in the act of turning, she caught herself and tried to rearrange her expression, but it was too late. She had shown that she recognized him, and she realized it. His foot was blocking the way before she could slam the heavy door shut. "Are you in trouble?" he asked. "Leave me alone," she said. "Please, please." "You're in trouble. Let me in." "You're trouble. Stay out." Pure Elphaba. His last doubts fled. He cracked the door open with his shoulder. "You're making me into a monster," he said, grunting with the effort. She was strong. "I'm not going to rob you or rape you. I just won't be ignored like that.
Why?
She gave up then, and he fell stupidly against the unplastered brick wall of the stairwell, like a pratfalling twit in a vaudeville hour.
"I remembered you as full of delicacy and grace," she said. "Did you catch something by accident, or did you study awkwardness?"
"Come on," he said. "You force someone to behave like a clumping boor. You give them no choice. Don't be so surprised. I can still manage grace. I can do delicacy. Half a minute."
"She's got to you," she said, eyebrows up, but mockingly. She wasn't really surprised. "Listen to those graduate school affectations. Where's the native boy wreaking that appealing naivete like a well-chosen musk?"
"You're looking well, too," he said, a bit hurt. "Do you live in this stairwell, or are we going someplace even a little bit homey?"
She cursed and mounted the stairs. They were covered with mouse turds and scraps of packing straw. A soupy evening light seeped in the grimy gray glass windows. At a bend in the stairs, a white cat was waiting, haughty and disaffected like all its kin. "Malky, Malky, meow, meow," said Elphaba as she passed it, and it deigned to follow her up to the pointy arched doorway at the top of the stairs.
"You're familiar?" said Fiero.
"Oh, that's rich," said Elphaba. "Well, I'd as soon be thought a witch as anything else. Why not? Here, Malky, some milk."
The room was large and seemed only casually arranged for dwelling. Originally a storeroom, it had barricaded double doors that could be swung outward to receive or dispense sacks of grain hauled up by a winch from the street. The only natural light fell in through a couple of cracked panes of glass in a skylight open 4 or 5 inches. Pigeon feathers and white and bloody phlox on the floor below. 8 or 10 crates in a circle as if for sitting. A bedroll. Clothes folded on a trunk. Some odd feathers, bits of bones, strung teeth, and a wizened dodo claw, brown and twisted like beef jerky. These were hung on nails pounded into the wall and arranged for art or for a spell. A sallow wood table, a nice piece of furniture that, whose 3 arching legs tapered down into elegantly carved doe's hooves. A few tin plates, red with white speckles. Some food wrapped in cloth and cord. A pile of books at the bedside. A cat toy tied to a string. Most effectively and gruesomely, the skull of an elephant hung on a rafter, and a bouquet of dried creamy pink roses emerged from the central hole in the hull of its cranium, like the exploding brains of a dying animal, he couldn't help thinking, remembering Elphaba's youthful concerns. Or maybe an homage to the putative magical talents of elephant. Below it hung a crude glass oval, scratched and chipped, used as a looking-glass, perhaps, though its reflective qualities appeared unreliable.
"So this is home," said Fiero, as Elphaba brought out some food for the cat and ignored Fiero some more. "Ask me no questions and I'll spell you no lies," she said. "May I sit down?" "That's a question."
But she was grinning.
"Oh, well, then, sit for 10 minutes and tell me about yourself. How did you, of all people, turn into a sophisticate?"
"Appearances are deceiving," he said. "I can afford the garb and affect the language, but I'm still an Arjiki tribal boy underneath."
"What is your life like?"
"Is there something to drink? Not alcohol. I'm just thirsty."
"I don't have running water. I don't use it. There's some questionable milk. At least Malky will still drink it. or perhaps there's a bottle of ale up there on the shelf. Help yourself."
She took a little ale in a pipkin, left the rest for him. He told her the barest outline of things, his wife, Sarima, the childhood bride grown up and grown fecund, their three children. The old Office of Public Works, Waterworks headquarters at Kiamo Co., which by ambush and occupation his father had converted to a chieftain's seat and a tribal stronghold back in the time of the Ozma Regent. The dizzying schizoid life of moving every year from the thousand-year grasslands in the spring and summer, where the clan hunted and feasted, to a more settled autumn and winter at Kiamo Co. "An Arjiki prince has business interests here in the Emerald City," said Elphaba. "If it were banking, you'd be in shiz. The business of this city is military, my old friend. What are you up to?"
"You've heard enough from me," he said. "I can play coy and deceptive, too, even if it's all pretend and no dark secrets to speak of." He guessed the quiet business of trade agreements would not impress his old friend. He was embarrassed his affairs weren't more audacious or thrilling. "But I've gone on. What of you, Elfie?"
She wouldn't say anything for a few minutes. She unrolled some dried sausage and some graying bread, and found a couple of oranges and a lemon, and put them unceremoniously on the table. In the mothy atmosphere, she looked more like a shadow than a person. Her green skin seemed oddly soft, like spring leaves at their tenderest, and beaten like copper. He had an unprecedented urge to grab her wrist and make her stop moving about, if not to make her talk, at least to keep her still so he could look at her. "Eat this stuff," she said at last. "I'm not hungry. You eat it. Go on."
"Tell me something," he begged. "You left us at Shiz. You disappeared like the morning fog. Why? Where to? And what then?"
"How poetic you are," she said. "I've a notion that poetry is the highest form of self-deception."
"Don't change the subject."
But she was agitated. Her fingers twitched. She called for the cat, and then irritated it and sent it flying off her lap. Finally she said, "Oh, well, this much then. But you're never to come here again. I don't want to have to find a new place. This is too good for me. Do you promise?"
"I will agree to consider promising, that's all. How can I promise any more than that? I don't know a thing yet."
She said hurriedly, "Well, I was fed up with Shiz. The death of Dr. Dillamon vexed me, and everybody grieved and nobody cared. Not really. It wasn't the right place for me anyway. All those silly girls. Although I liked Glinda well enough. How is she, anyway?"
"I'm not in touch. I keep expecting to run into her at some palace reception or other. I hear through the grapevine that she married a Paltos baronet."
Elphaba looked annoyed, and her back stiffened. "Only a baronet? Not a baron or a viscount, at least? What a disappointment! Her early promise was never to pan out, then."
Meant as a joke, her remark was stiff and unfunny.
"Is she a mother?"
"I don't know. I'm asking the questions now, remember?"
"Yes, but palace receptions?" she said. "Are you in cahoots with our glorious wizard?"
"I hear he's mostly gone reclusive. I've never met him," Fiyero said. "He shows up at the opera and listens behind a portable screen. At his own formal dinners he dines apart in an adjoining chamber behind a carved marble grill. I've seen a profile of a stately man walking along a promenade. If that's even the wizard, that's all I've met of him. But you, why did you cut us all off?"
"I loved you too much to keep in touch,"
What does that mean? Don't ask me, she said, thrashing a bit, her arms like oars rowing in the blue summer evening lightlessness. Yes, I am asking. Have you lived here ever since, for 5 years? Do you study? Do you work?